Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Cold. Three winters at the South Pole. Wayne White, author. You can hear your breath, like, super loud. It's a whole different atmosphere. So imagine the ambiance now. You're freezing. You've got it. Okay, maybe not. Wayne White, my guest. Veteran of U.S. Marine Corps, served as a civilian contractor in assignments around the globe for more than 25 years, nearly 3 years in the Antarctic program at the South Pole. All right, that's where the cold is, if in case there was any doubt. First, we're going to find out about the near-death experience. Not what you think it is, or not what I thought it was.
Point was, this music was really somber. As I'm walking down the street, this guy yells at me, goes, Senor Blanco, you know, White Blanco. He says, the American Embassy is looking for you.
You had a near-death experience, but it was not what I expected. Why don't we start with that?
Sure, Wendy. And first, it's an honor being on your show. I did some research, and you do some very fascinating material. So it's great to be talking to you today. Yeah, I had some fun with that when I mentioned, you know, near death, which it's not, but in another way it was. And that story goes back to 1985. I was down in Colombia in the Amazon region. There's a small sliver of Colombia that runs into the Amazon. If you know anything about 1985, that was a rough time in Colombia. There was a lot of things going on. The drug trade was really flourishing, and that Amazon port, it turned out, was a real hub for that type of thing. And I was down there, of all things, because I wanted to collect a blowgun and poison darts. That's what I was looking for. But I showed up down there, and immediately the place had kind of a bad feel because of the business, and people wondered what I was doing down there. At that time, a young American, you know, wanted to go out in the jungle, and I think, you know, they weren't really sure what I was. And I went downriver, and what happened, I should back up a little bit. I was on a Avianca flight flying into Colombia and flying to a little port called Leticia, an Amazon port. And when that plane landed, they told us all that Avianca had gone on strike. So I'm down in this little tiny sliver, the, you know, Colombian Amazon, and now I know that National Airline is on strike. So I'm thinking, you know, how am I ever going to get out of this place? How long can a strike be? But I head out, head up river, my goal being to get that blowgun, poison darts, and meet some of the Indians. I did that. I headed up river and did find an Indian tribe and did end up meeting some other interesting people, too, that later I found out a little more about what they were doing, but probably part of that trade that was occurring at that time. That's a whole other story. I can go on about that, which I won't, about meeting these people and the fact that they were very nice to me, considering what could have happened.
Okay, let's just interject here, because you could have been part, you know, CIA. You could have been a spy.
Absolutely.
That's the problem with you being in that area. Was it the Cali or Medellin? I can't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were, and the guys I were talking to were giving me, you know, really, they were polite, but they were giving me the real, you know, a lot of questions, what I was doing, you know, where, why was I there? Because I popped up out in their little place where they were building out of the jungle, carrying a poison dart and blowgun. And I had a story of where I'd been, and I spent an afternoon with these guys. And I knew, I felt okay about it. I knew it, you know, could certainly be serious. And later I found out who these guys were much later when, just to make a long story short, they were hooked up with an American that was down there doing certain things that at that time was the biggest cocaine bust in, I think it was U.S. history, happened in Florida. Here I am, the stupid guy coming out of the jungle with the poison darts and the blowgun. And that was a whole funny story what happened with them. There's some stuff. But the point was, in the end, they were good guys, and they gave me a ride down river back down to Leticia in this speedboat to get me out of that place. And it was very, very nice of them, considering what they could have done.
Yeah.
You know, if they were unsure, they were good fellows. And took me back down to Leticia. You know, I get out, I got my poison dart and blowgun, and I come through the little town, and I'm walking through, and I see that the Avianca office is open. it's just a little shack. If you knew what Leticia was in 1985, it was just a little frontier town, you know, kind of a shack thing. I know it's built up much more now, but this was many years ago. So I go in the office and I'm thinking, Jesus, I got to get out of here. Well, I can. If they went off strike, you know, I better go. And I hadn't been in, you know, there very long at all. But anyway, point is just enough to get the poison dart blowguns and spend a couple of days in Leticia. But I go in the office. I tell the woman I want to get out. When's the next airplane? And she says, mañana, it's tomorrow morning. I'm talking back and forth with her, and I say, okay, I'll go on that. And what I'm getting from her is, no, I for some reason, there's a no, even though she keeps saying mañana, there's a flight. So in the end, I can't really understand her. So what I do is just take the poison dart and the blowgun, and I head across the frontier into Brazil, which at that time you just walked and you were into Brazil, no border cross or anything. And I'm walking around in Brazil, and they speak right away. It's interesting. The Portuguese, right away, you notice the difference between Buenos Dias and Bom Dia. You know, Portuguese starts right away. I end up going into Brazil, and I end up meeting these slash and burn farmers that were young guys that were from the big city. I make camp. I spent, I don't know, wasn't long, a day or two there in Brazil, just camped out on their property. Or they had the big ranch or the farm thing. And then I came back into Leticia. And when I walked back into Leticia, come back, crossed the border, walked into the town, they're playing this somber music. And that was a real raucous little port where they'd have these speakers and they're playing, you know, really loud, raucous music and stuff. And you'd hear gunshots at night and all this stuff was going on. But the point was, this music was really somber. As I'm walking down the street, this guy yells at me, goes, Senor Blanco, you know, white Blanco. He says, the American embassy is looking for you. I'm like, holy shit, why would they be looking for me? So I go to his little hotel thing, and he puts me on the phone with the American embassy in Bogota. Really nice people, really nice guys. And they were really glad to hear my voice. And then I found out why. And what had happened was that when that woman at the Avianca office was telling me there was a flight in the morning, where I was not understanding her because my Spanish is so bad, was that, yes, there was a flight, but it wasn't an Avianca flight, but anybody could get on it to get out. It was a flight that was brought in by the government to break the strike, to get people out of that port, because they knew they had to get people out. So they flew this DC-6 in, and it would have loaded up any passengers, Avianca or otherwise. So I didn't understand that. So that's when I crossed the border into Brazil and didn't show up at the airfield. Well, what happened was that flight did come in. It loaded up 70-some people. It took off, and 10 miles out over the jungle, it crashed and killed everybody on board. I was on the manifest. She didn't understand me either, so she had me penciled in on the manifest. So I'm on this. So I'm in the newspaper, you know, that I was dead, you know, my wife at the time was being contacted by the embassy. Every so many bodies that they would identify, they'd say it wasn't him and it wasn't him and he wasn't in this group. So next thing you know, I'm on the phone with them and on the phone to her. And it was a fascinating experience because my bad Spanish saved me. And to this day, I've never worked on my Spanish language skills. So,
a hint. Maybe this is a good thing.
If I'd had a little bit better understanding of Spanish, or if she would have spoken better English, or if somebody came in that was an English speaker, I'd have been killed. Have been the end, because I would have been there. I would have wanted to get out when I could, because that place was kind of crazy down there. So, you know, fluke, not a fluke. Who knows? You know, you don't know. It's just something that it's funny, because at the time it was a tragedy. But as the years go by, I know that date. It was July 24th. And I've got a newspaper hanging on the wall with my name in that manifest. And I never forget that. What a terrible tragedy that was. And who knows? It was just a terrible experience, really. I still have the blowgun and poison dart.
Yeah, I read about that in the book. You were calling your wife to make sure that they had not fallen on the floor and killed the 18 cats.
Oh, my God. Yeah. She sent me this photo of one of my cats had gotten caught in the blinds. And it had happened once before while I was home for a little bit. And here's in the photo, I thought, oh, my God. You know, I didn't pay attention, but it was cute. Here it is. Tina did this little stupid thing. And I go back to my room and I'm in bed and it hit me. Oh, my God, those are poison darts on the floor. I run to the phone and tell my wife, Melissa, there's the cat knocked. Did you pick those poison darts up? And then it hit me later. I'm calling from the South Pole to tell my wife there's poison darts on the floor. What kind of life is that? You know?
You're a world traveler. You've been all over the place in military background, which means, you know, you have certain qualifications that allow you to go into some of these remote spaces and also spaces that not the general public doesn't have access to.
Yes. Yeah. I'm a Marine for many years ago. I did a single enlistment many years ago. And the whole reason I did that was to be at the time I wanted to be an ex-Marine. That might sound funny to say, but the point was I wanted that accomplishment at a young age, and I had no intention of staying in. I was going to go to college, but I wanted to be an ex-Marine. That's gone out of vogue, and then it became former Marine, then it became Marine veteran, and now we're just called Marines. Once a Marine, always a Marine. But the point is, I wanted that on my kind of resume of life, and not just the title. It doesn't mean anything. The thing about being a Marine and then having the confidence and stuff that would come from that, which then made me, you know, have the physical abilities and such to go to places in the world that a lot of people wouldn't go. And one of those places, of course, was New Guinea, which I talk about in the book. I did some pretty rough trips. If anybody knows anything about the island of New Guinea, it is probably one of the most primitive places on the planet. Very difficult to travel when you get back in those mountain jungles. And I've walked hundreds and hundreds of miles through those mountain jungles, usually alone or with, you know, villagers carrying stuff, but, you know, not on some Club Med holiday, people, some company or something, or one of these little trips they do now that they call expeditions, all on my own. And I did that many years ago, those kind of trips between there and some stuff in Africa, and then that little short trip to the Amazon. But yeah, I've been to some very remote areas and brought back some fascinating stuff from the jungle.
That's warm. All right. And you were in a warm spot when this all of a sudden popped onto the radar, and you said, well, I have to go here. No. It's like, and it was tough for you to go where you were. And then from that beautiful location, you're going to ice.
Yeah, I talk about that in the book, and that's the whole, you know, whole thing about cold. And I start off in the book explaining that cold isn't my natural desire, and I don't think it's most humans' desire. I got something out of it, but I love the tropics. And I was at out at Ascension Island and had a job that I thought I'd have forever. Ascension Island in the South Atlantic between Africa and South America, and it was the dream job that I'd waited a couple years for. And then that thing popped up with the South Pole. And it was because I hadn't done that. And I mentioned in the book about having this collection of stuff from polar explorers and having a room kind of dedicated to them. And even though I'd spent some time in Alaska, it wasn't the same. And I'd walk through the house and I'd see these things from these great explorers like, you know, Captain Scott or Roald Amundsen or Ernest Shackleton. And I had no real affinity for it. I just had a love of what they had done as far as the harshness. But I had no real affinity or appreciation for that ice. And this was my chance to fix that. And I gave up a hell of a job to do that.
3 winters you spent there.
Yeah, and people have spent more. In fact, the record for winters is like 15 winters that was done by a German scientist. And I mentioned it in the book. There was a 15 and there was a 14. And then after that, it's not as many winters, winter being most of the year. And never to diminish the great number that these guys did in what they do. They do their own thing. They you know, have this time off in between. And you can almost make it a lifestyle. As a leader, you're in a whole different situation. And it's and I think what echoes that the best or would explain it is in the 65 years or so since we've had a South Pole station with 65 individual crews going in and out of that place, the winter managers, only 2 others did 2 winters. Mm. And I'm the only one to do 3. So most are one and done. And it's for a reason they're one and done.
Okay.
It's not easy.
Yeah. You're responsible. If there's any kind of a hazard, that's on your shoulders.
Anything that happens, everything that happens is on your shoulders. And so, you know, I take leadership quite seriously, and some in the past have not. They weren't really maybe as fit for the job, and I take it very seriously. So what that meant to me was I'm on duty 24 hours a day for a year, and that's just kind of how it was.
Some people can't do the kind of pressure change that you don't anticipate getting into that environment.
No, you're absolutely right, Wendy. And the fact is that we had people fly out in the summertime. Now, just so for your listeners, the summer at the South Pole is the short period, which goes November 1st to about February 15th. 24 hours a day of light. It's warmer. The warmest it ever was when I was there was a +9, but generally it runs around zero. It's in the negatives, but still it's light 24 hours a day, and I consider that quite warm. The winter from February 15th all the way till around November 1st, when that small crew of 42 is isolated there with no way out, that temperature, the average temperature is minus 76 Fahrenheit, and that's average. It's much colder, and it's dark for a number of those months, completely dark, 24 hours a day. Now, you mentioned that barometric pressure. It's at the South Pole Station. The Amundsen's got South Pole Station, sits at 9,300 feet of elevation, almost 2 miles of ice on an old continent below. People fly out there from the coast, and it doesn't matter. There's no rhyme or reason to why. I've seen the most fit people have a problem, and people that maybe weren't as fit get there, and all of a sudden they've got like high altitude sickness. You've got to get them out of there. Mm-hmm. Happens every summer. Very dangerous.
Yeah, it's frightening, and that's the thing. It's unpredictable, like you're saying.
Yeah, you don't know. I mean, I saw a fireman come in, this fit young fireman, and I watched him go out with an oxygen bottle about 2 days later and walking like he was 100 years old, and they're taking him to the aircraft. It didn't matter how fit he was. It just wasn't his thing with that altitude.
Well, and the one thing you can't afford in the middle of the winter when no one gets in or out is any kind of illness.
Oh, no. And that's why, you know, you have a doctor and a PA or a nurse there, the two, and then you have a team that trains with them to assist. But if you have a serious problem, there's a good chance you just would die there. In fact, many years ago, you used to sign a release saying that, something along the lines of, I know if something happens to me in the winter, I won't be able to get out of here, and I'm okay with that. Now, there was in 2016 a midwinter evacuation, which was a miracle the way they put that together. But I was in the Denver office at the time, and I watched the plane. I watched how that happened, and that is not something that you can count on ever happening again, where they were able to get this small aircraft in the midwinter.
Well,
you have
to go. Yeah, the weather conditions, everything.
Absolutely. They had the stars just aligned right. There was a moon. There was the weather was just warm enough so the fuel wouldn't freeze. They didn't have any storms. I mean, the chances of it all happening like that again, you just have to say when you go down there, count on you're not coming out. And people have died during the winter and just gotten stored till you know, the first plane came to take them away. That's just how it's set up.
The pictures, you've included pictures where the ice is just all around. You said like the first trip out there, you got a real quick taste of frostbite.
Yeah, it didn't take anything. I just got off the plane on an aircraft. It was the very end of October, maybe around October 28th or so of 2016. I get off the aircraft and I'm new to this kind of environment. And it was, I remember the temperatures, minus 58, and there was a wind too. And within just a minute or two, I'm standing around trying to help and do something with the luggage. And someone said, hey, your nose is freezing. And in just that couple minutes, I had frostbite on the tip of my nose. A valuable lesson to learn within the first hour of being there.
That didn't set you back. Every single day you went out, Wayne was here, 98, as in minus 98. Wayne was here 1.5 miles. It's pitch dark. And you're away from the station a mile and a half. Okay.
I proceeded cautiously with that. I've never been a daredevil. I've done some things that most people haven't, but I've never been the daredevil in a group. I'm methodical and I'm careful, and I was careful with that. That first day scared me to see what could happen that quickly. You could freeze that fast, and that's in, you know, summer with the sun. Later, I find minus 58 warm. I would call that warm weather. And as a matter of fact, one day I was walking, and it was in the wintertime, and a wind was blowing, and it occurred to me, oh, this is a warm breeze, like on my face. It was minus 65. Now with that, I have this balaclava, and you've seen the photos on my book cover. I'm all covered up, so it's not truly hitting my face, and I've got this void space I'm breathing into. But the point was, I learned later, you know, I learned taking it cautiously through the summers, that first summer, how to, you know, how to deal with that cold, how to dress right, how to travel through the ice, how to travel in the darkness with that small headlamp, being very cautious and careful. I was having fun with that when I wrote that mile and a half, minus 98, Wayne was here. I was as alone as anyone on the planet out there, just a mile and a half at that point from the station. But you're in a lethal environment. And so I used to tell my crew when I would do the cold weather training, prepare them for the winter, I'd say there's death outside that window. And I wasn't being melodramatic. I wanted them to take it really, really seriously, because it's a lethal environment. Unless you're prepared for it, you know, mentally, physically, the clothes and all that, you could get yourself in a real bad way quickly. I had a pair of mucklucks that I would wear, and I loved them because they were light and they were quiet. And what I found out is I could take them out in about minus 100, but I would only do that when I was out on like the flag line, walking that flag line, because what I was afraid of was at a certain point they could break, that gum rubber could freeze and it would break. And boy, if I was out on my grid south route, as it was called, which is out, you know, in the middle of nowhere, and my boots froze and broke, I'd lose my feet. I mean, it'd be bad.
You talked
so
about,
I was always careful.
You talked about being able to find your way in a whiteout. How do you do that?
Yeah. Well, I practiced in the summers because what I would do is I'd get out some distance from the station, and then I had compasses I would carry, and I would practice where I was. I knew roughly where I was out there, even in the darkness and all that, what the compass should say as far as which way the station was. North, south, east, west meant nothing on the compass, but I would know 240 degrees is the station from where I'm at in this grid south. So if I stayed on that line, but I would do it to just build up confidence. I'd spin around in a storm and stuff and try to disorient myself and then, you know, work my way back. And I wasn't all that far from the station. I might only be a couple of miles away, but a couple of miles away, you know, in a condition like that is really dangerous. And really people need to be careful, you know, doing something like that. I just became quite experienced with it. But Wendy, what I never became was lackadaisical, overconfident, or, you know, not understanding how serious things could turn bad.
Okay, yeah. So with that, though, your crews, and you talk about the difference between the first year, the second year, and the third year, and being able to choose everybody and still having some slip through the cracks, because in this environment, you're talking 8 months, and it's the same face every day, and sometimes those faces get to be rather annoying.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it was something where one thing I've learned about writing a book is that when you write a book and you ask 100 different people what they think, you're going to get 100 different answers. Mm-hmm. You wrote too much about food. You didn't write enough about food. You wrote too much about yourself. You didn't write enough about yourself. You wrote, you know, it goes back and forth. And I wanted, though, to go through the selection process. And I did that. I think I did a pretty good job of how that worked with the selection process in the beginning, because it's fascinating to interview a person that will say about anything that you want to hear in order to go to the South Pole and be part of one of those crews. And you're looking at them at a nice desk in Denver, and he or she is dressed up, you know, very nice, and they're being very pleasing, and they want the job. And then you see them 6 months later when they're disheveled
and they don't like kale.
No, and they don't like kale. And the next thing you know, there's a fight over the most stupid thing, you know, and they're upset with so-and-so over something that, you know, you wouldn't even think about in a normal society, but down there it looms large. So when you're choosing these crew members, you know, you do the best you can, and you realize you're still going to have some people that will have issues. And we did. And then it's a matter of recognizing that, and hopefully you've got a crew that'll get in, see those things, and will help. You shouldn't just be the, you know, the winter manager.
Well,
and I always felt that.
There's another condition there that can happen, and this isn't predictable. This is when the personality, that issue, you know, it's a stress.
There's a term. Yeah, it's the T3, I think they call it. And it's a thing that they're doing research on where it has to do with, because of lack of sunlight and isolation and things, that there's some kind of an enzyme or something that doesn't get manufactured or something. And then you have depression. And then you have maybe an attitude changes. Maybe a person's angers really easily. I saw it. I saw people that were started off as, you know, normal human beings and nice and polite. And then sometimes they would kind of flip, like a switch flip. And we took vitamin D3, I think it was something that supposedly helped. I don't know if it did or didn't. I always felt pretty good, and I took it. I can't speak for other people. I don't know if it's just maybe a placebo. But you would definitely see those changes in habits and attitudes. And that's why I mentioned in the book a lot about an active social thing is a good thing to keep people. I don't mean socializing like party drinking all the time. I'm talking about lectures, talks, gym stuff, athletic things to keep people kind of busy, and then also busy on their jobs. Their jobs was number one. And so there's a lot to that. In fact, funny enough, I'm speaking at the Mars Convention in Tempe, Arizona, in a few weeks. I've got just a short talk. They've got many, many speakers for the Mars Society Convention, Mars Society, and it's these advocates for Mars exploration and us, you know, getting to Mars.
Yeah.
And my short talk is going to be on the South Pole and Mars, and I'll talk about, you know, in a Martian colony, you're going to have those same things. You're going to have these people that are going to be doing all kinds of things like our people did, working and such. They aren't going to be astronauts in the long distant future. They're going to be craftsmen and things like that. People, you know, doing jobs and such, and the kind of things that you can get with people in isolation, which we saw at the South Pole.
I think with your experience, the 3 years is also a better assessment because you have different types of people, some that were returning who had a different attitude because they were coming back, and then some, the newbies, and then you had the millennials, which, you know, all of a sudden these different types of, they've grown up in different environments with different expectations. That brings more to the equation as well.
Well, thanks for that. Yeah, and that's why, you know, when I mentioned the difference between myself and my three winners as a leader, and our scientists that have done those multiple winters, I think it's great what they did, but they didn't see it from the leader's view. They would have seen the crews through the years and probably have some fascinating stories, but it's not the same as when you hold the bag for the whole thing and you're responsible for everything. And over those 3 winters, because I did the 3, I did get to see a difference in different types of crews, from my first crew, which just kind of fell together, which was really a great crew, to my second crew, which I had a lot of impact and input into selecting them. And that was a hardcore bunch of mostly, you know, 50% South Pole winter veterans, and then a number of other people with Antarctic experience. That was quite a group. And my last group, which, because I had done a back-to-back winter, I wasn't in Denver to select them. And I got a real strong core group of millennials, which was an eye-opener for me.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. These are social issues. These are psychology, psychological. What's the impact? Can you be alone? And it sounds to me like you even chose to eat alone, because I think, it, for one thing, it established your leadership, and you're not going to play favorites, even if you might have one or two. It gave you a little bit of a buffer so that, well, for one thing, you didn't become a nanny.
Yeah, and I, Wendy, you know, I hit that in the book, and some people will understand it, some people won't like it, some people will, whatever, because they haven't been in such a situation. In the Marines, there was a phrase, probably it's in the Navy and such too, but in the officer corps, which was familiarity breeds contempt. And I believe that to a point. I think with smart people, it doesn't necessarily have to, but I never wanted to be too familiar to my crews, because it set me apart, and God damn it, in the end, it was better for them. I was an authority figure. I got a lot of respect from those guys. I really did. And I used that so that I always stayed an authority figure. I wasn't involved. You know, I didn't involve myself in things. If I was really honest, and I couldn't really do it, I chose not to. I could have really written some stories about some past winters and the leaders that crossed the line with crew members and social events and such. And I just didn't want to turn that into that. I just kind of allude a little bit to it. But the truth was, as a leader, you've got to be just about perfect. And nowhere near was I perfect, but I stayed kind of untarnished from the, you know, I didn't go get a girlfriend, and I didn't go do these other things that would have put me, you know, drinking with the crew and such. And it wasn't easy for me always to do that. I enjoyed my crews and such, but it was better for them. And
you had to smell the, when you were saying, you know, avoiding the alcohol, there were a couple of times when the Bloody Marys were just a little bit too fragrant.
The Bloody Marys, I could smell it. And they were putting, you know, stuff in it and seasonings and things. And each one is showing, you know, these other ones that their Bloody Mary was the best. And it was just, I was in agony, and I'm there, you know, I was happy they were having a good time. There was a scotch tasting thing too, where they brought in this really good scotch, and I'm looking at it like, God, I'd love to do this. But, you know, I just wanted to just keep that gulf. And I do mention in the book, once during the middle of winter, I had a toast with the crew when we lost a crew member, a real tragic situation off ice. What happened to him is a terrible thing. And so the crew was down, and I had dinner with him, and then we had a drink and a toast to him. But I kept that gulf. I did it on purpose. I think then, in retrospect, being really honest, having to look at myself, you know, look deeply within, I do see that I like being alone, that it's something that I naturally kind of gravitate to. But with that, it was something that I did based on things that I knew that had occurred in the past. And it would be better for the crews if I kept that distance. And I think they would agree.
Also, the fact that you had a huge responsibility 24/7. If a fire breaks out, if an engine breaks down, if somebody gets sick.
Yeah, yeah. When we had some things burn up that started, you know, put it through the vents, and this it was a potentially toxic atmosphere. You have fires at any time. So I in that position, am on duty 24 hours a day, and I wanted to make sure that there was never, you know, that if something happened, I was ready for it. And stuff would happen, you know, thank God it was never any tragedies, but you have to be ready for it. That's just kind of how, you know, a place like that, you've got to be ready for a major occurrence. And I was always ready. And so I felt good about that.
This was as simple as somebody leaving a water bottle, plastic water bottle near the sauna and it heating up.
Yeah.
Little tiny things like that. It just takes one issue to create a cascade effect.
Oh, absolutely. And we had a person, I mentioned it, I don't go into detail, but into great detail, but we interviewed her and a person I really liked for a winter over position. And she actually had done an earlier winter, but she had some lapses of judgment that from being tired, whatever the heck happened, and water ran down into some places there into electrical systems that could have knocked the elevator out for the entire season, the freight elevator, which would mean you'd be carrying boxes up 90 some steps for the entire winter. And it would have been a nightmare. And I couldn't in my mind come to the conclusion that it wouldn't happen again. So we just couldn't have the person on the crew, no matter how much I liked her. We couldn't have a lapse in judgment like that. And in the winter, if people get tired, you know, that's the thing with safety and such. That's when you need to be more careful. When the guy's standing on the ladder and he's standing on the top of it, when you're not supposed to stand on the top of the ladder, you can't do stuff like that. You're tired. You're going to make a mistake. You're going to fall off and hurt yourself or kill yourself. So you got to be vigilant.
Wayne White and the book Cold, 3 Winters at the South Pole. I did manage to sneak in some paranormal stuff. That's in the next segment. Wendy's Coffee House.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Wendy's Coffee House. Wayne White, the book Cold, 3 Winters at the South Pole. He's a member of the Explorers Club of New York City and the Adventurers Club of Los Angeles. In 2020, he got the Adventure of the Year Award from the Adventurers Club of Los Angeles. So he's been around the block a time or two. Being in the right place at the right time, sometimes there's an intuition that goes with that. And there might be just a tiny glimpse of the paranormal. He doesn't seek it out, but that doesn't mean he hasn't experienced it.
The people at the battlefield said I could camp there, which was a great honor. They said, but you won't probably spend the night because the last people we let do this ran in the middle of the night, took off and ran, afraid of whatever was there.
We'll come back to that later in this segment. That intuitive element has to be strong for you.
Yeah, I've been in a number of situations that probably could be considered dangerous, like when in New Guinea, going through some of the areas with the tribal wars and such. And in Africa years ago, and I walked, walked up to the battlefields area. The country was kind of coming unglued. I'm very, very confident in my ability to take care of myself in these places, not stupidly so. And I'm very, very cautious and careful. I have been in some situations that, I imagine could go south. But a lot of it is, to me, you know, physical preparation, being physically fit, being really vigilant where you can see some of these things, you know, before they become problems. And but that's just what's happened. I've been through 2 wars now too. And it's just something that goes to my nature to be cautious, vigilant, and careful.
Logic doesn't always add up when you have to make a snap decision. You don't have time to think. You have time to run.
No, I agree. Then there's something to be for intuition. If something doesn't feel right, there's a feeling there. I don't know. You know, I'm not the thing with the supernatural and stuff. I know you get into some of that stuff. And I think that's really cool. I'm very interested in it. I'm not one of these people that I've had a few, but that spends my life, you know, dwelling on things. But intuition, you know, when I got to that battlefield, you know, Santa Juana battlefield in South Africa, and they let me camp on it, I'd walked 120 miles to get there. And if anybody knows anything about the Battle of the Santa Juana, the British over 1,000 were killed by the Zulu the Zulu tribe that attacked, and they lost many warriors too, but it was a bloody, you know, it's a bloodbath right at the base of this little mountain there. And I'd walk to get there because it meant a lot to me to do that and arrive on foot. And the people at the battlefield said I could camp there, which was a great honor. And they said, but you won't probably spend the night because the last people we let do this ran in the middle of the night, took off and ran, and afraid of whatever was there. I set up camp at that battlefield, and then once that sun went down, I'd never had more of a foreboding feeling of, you know, I don't know what was there. I know it sounded like people talking outside my tent, which was strange. Got up, checked it out. It was cold. It felt so cold. All those guys had been killed, and it was a terrible, terrible, if you want to talk about a vortex of negativity, it was probably there. But they tolerated me, and I got the hell out of there the next morning.
I think you went in with the right attitude, and you asked permission. So there are some things like that when you go into a space that is that intense and that full, because it is full. That's what's going on. You were just there to say, I think in a way, say thank you. I appreciate your service, whoever
absolutely.
And whatever you are.
And that is exactly what I did. In fact, I carried some whiskey with me, and I had a toast to those guys and poured some on the graves. And it was with utmost respect for that 24th Regiment and what they had done there, and those Zulus too that had died defending their kingdom. And I went in there with that respect and was just surprised by this cold feeling. But I've done that. My house that I have here in Rockport, people think it's haunted. It was built in 1868. And I've had people say, oh, you live in the haunted house. When I got the place many years ago, 20-some years ago, I know people have died in the house and such. No, not any of the tragic things, not any, like a murder.
Yeah.
People have died. And I knew that. And I made my peace with it like the first night. And I never remember talking to the house and saying, okay, here's the deal. I'm going to love you. I'm going to take care of you. Anybody that's in here, I'll be your best friend. But please, no apparitions in the middle of the night or something like that. Please, just let's. It's fantastic. But some of the things that I brought back, I do the same thing. That I brought back things from the jungle and some odd, strange things that I also make a peace with. And I've never had anything but good feelings. But I have brought back some strange things. That definitely has led to some strange things.
They would have their own energy. So is there one that you could share as an example?
Yeah, because it's a terrible story, but it's something that happened that I think your listeners would be interested in. Because my life isn't in the paranormal, isn't anything like this. I wouldn't say I don't have affinity for it. I'm very fascinated by it, but I just have other things that I kind of focused on.
Yeah.
However, I always have a deep respect, and I, for some reason, I'm drawn to places that have been great trauma battlefields and things like that. And I've got stories around the world where I've been in some of these places and strange things. But what I'm leading up to here is a very tragic event that occurred with something I brought back years ago, many years ago. I was in New Guinea in the mountains there, and these are tribal areas, and a guy wanted to trade this rock. And I knew it was an important rock. It was in this bag that was made out of animals and pieces of rats and bones and all this stuff. And he wouldn't bargain. He wanted me to have it. He wouldn't bargain. He had a certain price of things he wanted, but he wouldn't go down. He wouldn't do anything. And all he would tell me was, never show it to anybody. Don't let anybody ever see it. So I knew that it was whatever it was. I didn't totally understand it, but I always kept it in the bag, kept it alone. And it's a strange rock. It always feels cold. I don't know what this thing is. I don't know. But I have a couple of times I've used it for things, tried to just thinking it had some type of power. And it's odd how it works. But I'm just going to go into one instant, and that's all.
Mm-hmm.
I had a cat, a little cat. Her name was Mary. And she was given a diagnosis that was pretty grim from a veterinarian. Well, poor little Mary already has had a hard time in life with other maladies, and I used that rock, and I used it and made my own prayers and did what I could do. And after Mary had to go in for another check and things weren't looking good, and she was taken by a neighbor that worked at the vet's office, so she came by and picked up little cat Mary in her little pink case, took her to the vet, and I was thrilled because I got a call. Mary was fine. That this thing that thought was a cancer or stuff was fine. And she brings Mary back, and I'm just so ecstatic. And I get back in the house, and I got a little case, and I'm no sooner trying to unzip the little thing to get her out than my phone rings. And that person that had just taken my cat to the vet had just run over and killed another cat, one of my cats, one of our cats. It was actually kind of a joint cat. At that moment, I got one, but I lost this other one in just this freak thing that occurred right next door. That I don't know, just seemed to me.
Right, yeah.
I got one, but I lost the other.
A price.
That was the price.
Yeah,
the
there
price
was a price.
Paid. And it was just, I mean, it was just too quick, and it was just too awful. And
yeah. Okay, that's what people need to hear, because sometimes you have respect, and so there's a difference with your personality, your attitude, your energy that takes this a whole different direction. But that's an example of some of these tools and some of these, they're a talisman. They are real. They are alive. They have an energy attached
yeah.
to them. And if you don't know what you're doing, you can get yourself in trouble.
Yeah, that was an example for me, because then actually I did a little more research and I could never find out. And then it turns out that some of these rocks are used as weapons. So it's hard to say what this thing was. I know that, you know, whatever, it just was too strange of a coincidence that one's back from the dead almost, and then the other one's dead that instant. I'm very careful with that rock. I don't take it lightly, and I don't take a number of things that I have in my old house lightly, even the house itself. But I treat these things with great respect and love.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say that. I've had nothing but good. It's a good feeling in my house. I love it. And here's a quick best quick story. Many years ago, I came home from overseas, and my house had been locked up for months, and it was before I had an alarm system. I walked through the house, and I see this old rifle, and it's in my leather chair. And I thought to myself, I don't remember leaving this rifle, this old antique rifle,
uh-huh.
in the leather chair. And I started laughing, thinking, yeah, but this has been closed up. Who knows what's happening in this place? And I was fine with it, thinking, okay, these guys, they were having some fun while I was gone.
They were on guard.
And I was,
yeah.
And I was just fine. And then I walk back in the back of the house, and I see it's got these beautiful old wood floors, and I see this little bit of like debris. It was like grass or something. And oh boy. And what had happened was there was a pane missing from one of the windows. And one of these old windows that I thought, God, I don't know if they even had a lock, but I just assumed they were probably painted shut from being 100 years old. Turns out there are these old windows that have like a weight in them. You could lift it with your feather, or the feather, I mean, like your finger. I didn't realize that they still worked well. Point is, someone had broken a pane, climbed in, gone through the house, looked at everything, climbed back out, shut the window, and didn't take anything. I think when they saw this stuff in the dark with a flashlight, probably.
Uh-huh. Yeah. They probably got really cold.
Cold. It was time to go. Now, but the only thing that happened with a friend of mine, what he said was, he's Chinese and he's kind of superstitious. He came over and said, Wayne, actually, you need to look at this. This glass is all broken from the inside out. So I don't know, you know.
Oops. They got rid of one that didn't belong.
Yeah, that might have been what happened.
Yeah, they had to wait for you to leave because you'd be sentimentally attached to it. Oh, no, no, no.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He didn't see you, dude, and we're not going to let him see you. Yeah. Okay.
That's what happened.
That's the kind of energy when you're going to be isolated in this weather, this cold and bone chilling, you know, frostbite within minutes, and any longer and you're dead. There has to be something else about you that goes as a protection for other people that you're not even conscious of. Because when you're talking about doing your due diligence of avoiding alcohol, trying not to get too familiar with the people that you're in charge of and you're responsible for, that's a very unique personality.
Well, thanks. It's hard for me. I was telling my wife the other day, it's really hard for me. I think I'm self-aware as far as all my flaws, or at least the ones I know of. There's probably all kinds of other ones I'm just not seeing yet. But I try to be self-aware. And I mentioned that in the book about flaws. And the reason I mentioned some of the things with mine are, when I started writing this book, I remember reading something that everybody writes themselves, the hero in their own novel. And boy, I didn't want to do that. That really bothered me. The thought that, you know, I can be heroic. I know that. That's my nature, but that isn't, you know, that's just sort of a natural thing. But the point is, was that we're all flawed individuals, and I've got my own problems and things like that. And I had no problem pointing those things out in the book. But it's hard for me to see what other people might see when they see me, when they're around me. I don't really know what that is, but I do know this. I do believe in protecting people. I think we're precious. I think that people are the most important thing in this universe. And I love whales and such. They're really cool. They swim around and blow bubbles and they sing songs. But people are something else. And although there's times when we can be horrific, absolutely horrific, I also think we're just fantastic. And so I try to keep that, you know, I try to keep that and give people breaks for what they are. We're all different. We're all the product of a million occurrences that have happened. And if you really think about it, give people, you know, give them some thought to why they are, you know, the way they are, you'll understand them better and you might like them better too. That's what I find.
Well, that's what you do in this. You try to find a purpose for each and every person who's at the station in your crew. And, you know, they bring diverse backgrounds, diverse ideology, the whole nine yards, but they all have a specific reason for being there. And you take advantage of that.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I mentioned in there, example, greeting them in the morning. And I remember one time, and it's in the book, a guy asked me, Wayne, do you really care when you greet us? And I said, I sure do, because I'm assessing you when I greet you. If I have somebody that, you know, comes up and I mentioned this in there about a guy that once said, when I said, how are you doing? He goes, okay. Well, okay. I know how he normally is. Usually pretty upbeat kind of fellow. Now he's just okay. All right. Now we're going to talk. But, you know, you're assessing the crew. And I say this too, you know, I never had children. And, I don't know. You know, I have all these cats now, and I love cats. I just love them. But this was kind of a chance in a way. And I don't think there's a greater, you know, greater good than, you know, taking care of people. And at the South Pole, you know, you're dealing with some very, very diverse people, diverse ways of thinking, diverse talents. There's nothing quite like it. And it was I just would just say how happy I am and thankful, it's a better word. Thankful for being in such a situation where I could use what I think of my talents to do, you know, to do good.
Yeah.
It was a good thing.
The one I think sour taste would be the tourists.
Yeah. And I know I was hard on that. And there are a couple of things with the tourists is just that, I don't know. I don't want to, I'm not one of these eat the rich because they paid $96,000 to fly down there for 2 hours. You know, I mean, that means they did better in life than I did financially if they've got $96,000 to fly to the pole for 2 hours. But then again, God, for that kind of money, I would do so many other things. But I was harsh on the tourists. There's different kinds of tourists. The guys that fly down there and pay the $96,000 and take their photo, they're mostly nice people, mostly folks that, you know, they've probably done all kinds of things. And this is one of these bucket list type things. The ski tourists were a little bit different. And my thing with them, where I had a certain harshness, because I'm a member of organizations. I'm a member of the Explorers Club of New York and also of the Adventure Club of Los Angeles. And so I'm around a lot of adventurous people. And I love that. And I respect athleticism and all that. But I also am a great believer in respecting those great guys from the past that went before in a place like the South Pole. And, what happens is you've got a guy like, you know, Robert Falcon Scott, who died down there, Roald Amundsen first to the pole, the great Ernest Shackleton, 97 miles from the pole and turns around and saves his men instead of dying, which he would have if he'd have kept going. And then you get these new guys now that are down there, men and women that are skiing around with satellite phones and rescue planes waiting and the newest equipment possible. And then they're going to get compared to someone like Robert Falcon Scott. No way. And that's the problem I have. And it's something where it isn't so much, I don't want to diminish the athleticism of people that are down there skiing around doing things, because I do admire athleticism. But the people that have gone before them, those great explorers that had their backs truly up against the wall, were you know, you can't compare to them. And it's with the respect, the same as I have for in my old house. I've got a lot of things that were owned by great explorers, and I'm humbled by being around these things, to have these things looking down from walls and shelves and things, and, you know, being just what I am, which is nothing compared to what they were. I'm humbled by that. And some of these folks that are skiing around and doing things aren't very humble at any point. So it kind of rubs me wrong.
What's your next project?
I don't know, Wendy. Right now it's the book. It's the book. And then I'm working on some things. I've got a couple speaking things to do. And I have another book actually that I wrote before Cold. And I shelved it because I thought Cold would be more popular. It might be better to do that first. I might start working on that if there's an interest. And then I am looking at an adventure and possibly going back to New Guinea or a place like that again.
I'd like to hear more about your artifacts because you're a history buff and you have a lot more awareness about the backstory and the value of these things than a lot of people do.
Yeah, thanks for that. When I have people come by, you know, some people come by and I'll give them tours of the house, and my God, it would take days if you really got into, I mean, there's things I got on eBay. There's things I got on, you know, collections that were, you know, online collections and such, but many things I collected in place and have great stories. It is an aura. I think to me, it gives off a certain energy just being surrounded by this stuff. And I love it, but I do have an affinity for it. I also realize it's just stuff. In the end, it's all just stuff. We can't take it with us. But there's some great stories to tell. And I always, if you ever get down to South Texas, I'd love to give you a tour.
Okay. Well, and what is in South Texas stays in South Texas, okay? Because just FYI.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've had some interesting nights with friends over here before. We had some good times.
You have a whole lot of partying going on.
Oh, boy.
At the museum is what comes to mind.
Yeah. You just got to kind of go with it, you know, once it starts.
See, you downplay this. Oh, I don't have any interest in it, but I do respect it. Okay, that's very, very serious. I do respect it. Oh, yeah, you have a few stories you're not sharing because
I have a few. Yeah, I have a few. You know, I don't know. It's just, I would say it wasn't a focus in my life. It's something that just happened with other things that I've done, traveling and working around the world and such. And I don't know what kind of affinity I have with these things, but I do know that I respect it. I certainly do. And I don't poo-paw anything. You know, I have to say one thing, you know, I'm not a, like I mentioned in my book about UFOs, I'm actually a member of a UFO group, but I'm a real skeptic to most of all of it. I wish to God, I want there to be UFOs. I want alien encounters. And herein lies kind of the problem with that, I think, sometimes. When you want it so much, you know, you got to be careful on your thinking. But what I'm leading to was, I had a guy recently, when I was, just came back from 7 months out of Kwajalein Atoll, and a guy, he saw my South Pole hat. And he comes walking up to me at I was having lunch or something, and he says, I see your South Pole hat. Can you talk to me about the aliens down there? And I said, you know, there's no aliens. I was there 3 years, no aliens. And then he stops for a second. He goes, well, okay, you can tell me the truth. Tell me the truth. Tell me the real truth. It's okay. I can take it. Tell me about the aliens. And I said, you know, I was out for over 4,000 miles over a 3-year period. And I only had one experience that seemed odd. And I could, I figured out what it was. It was natural phenomena. And I noticed he seemed kind of down, his shoulders kind of slumped. And then I said to him, but you know, if I were an alien, would I tell you the truth? And he seemed to perk up at that. So,
okay. Well, and when you're out there alone on the ice, under the stars, you would think if anything would appear, that would be the place to see it.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's all kinds of incredible, you know, conspiracy type theories about such. And I was out for a lot, like I say, over 4,000 miles, not far from the station, but around through the station and in the dark for hours and hours and hours over those 3 years. And I only saw one thing, and I mentioned in the book that it took me first, it surprised me, and then I figured it out. But yeah, I would have seen it. And, you know, I want there to be aliens. I think it's great. I'll watch Men in Black again. I love that.
Well, and see, I don't think just because one person doesn't see them that it isn't possible. I think each of us have a unique purpose here. You know, some people have the ability to hear it, to sense it, to feel it, to see it. It isn't on your ticket at this point or at this moment, but it doesn't mean it couldn't happen. And there are very few people who would go to the battlefield you did and camp there overnight, just saying.
No, yeah, I know. And I know what you're saying. And I'll tell you, you know, and it doesn't mean that I would be tuned into everything, too, as you mentioned. Maybe UFOs are different. That's a different frequency. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I have an affinity to that kind of thing. Another thing I didn't write about this, but it'll be in my book if my contract book comes out. When I was out years ago on Wake Island, a tiny little speck is a famous World War II Marine battlefield out in the Pacific. There was a place where 98 U.S. contractors were murdered by the Japanese in 1943, taken to the beach and machine gunned. And you want to talk about an area that has, you talk about just a terrible occurrence that had happened there in 1943. And sometimes I'd go over there late at night after watching movies with a dear friend of mine. And I'd go over there in that darkness and just talk, say hello or whatever. I never felt darkness like that. It just was amazing. I'd had some scotch and stuff too. So I wasn't conversing with any, ghosts that I saw, but the point was I wanted to be there. I wanted to at least acknowledge them,
Yeah. Yeah.
Fascinating.
I'm glad that you are writing, because I think you've got some great stories to share.
Well, this has been fascinating. It's a nice angle on this too. It's interesting when I first talking about the book and such, there's people that want to talk, that are interested in the stations make up the physical side to it. And that's all interesting, but I was hoping that there'd be some interest generated by other aspects of what I wrote. I didn't want to hit it too heavy, some of these things, but I wanted it out there about some of these experiences and things, just so maybe people have a better understanding of where I was coming from to have the views that I did, on the experience that I had. So this has been fun.
For anybody who wants to go to Mars or is thinking of those kinds of travels, in our future, you've got an up close and personal vision there to say, hey, this is my experience and consider this.
Yeah, thanks for that. And I'm looking forward to the Mars convention. It's going to be the Mars Society convention, because it's going to be a different crowd that I'm used to speaking to. I've done it for a number of adventure type groups and things like that. And we speak that same kind of language, but these are going to be more scientific people. Still, it should go well. It'll be a different kind of a crowd.
Yeah, well, they have to do the prep work for this. You don't put people out there without dealing with the psychology behind the personalities that you put on a crew.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Wendy, there's and funny enough, when I was at the South Pole, we found this National Geographic series called Mars, and it's more of a movie type thing about future Martian colonization. And it's a couple of seasons long, but there's a scene in there where a guy basically goes crazy just from the isolation. He ends up doing something with an airlock and killing a bunch of people. And I see that as totally possible.
I do too. There are people who cannot handle isolation. And you have to know that before you set these scenarios up.
Absolutely.
Keep us informed on what your next project is. I'm looking forward to some of the artifact stories.
Yeah, that'd be fun. There was some things on YouTube, I think, where I talk about some of my collection. But we could do something. I just did some stories or something about some things, because there's some interesting pieces in there.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad they don't hurt the cats.
Oh, I love my cats, and they get along really. They seem to get along really well in there. They're pretty protected.
I think so. I think that stone is a protection stone. It's your stone.
I hope
it's
it is.
Personal. No, it's personal. That's why it's not supposed to be seen by anyone else. And he gave it to you as a gift.
It was, and it was interesting in that was a big thing. No one ever sees it but you.
Yeah.
And that was the one thing I could get with our languages, and he could only speak the tribal language, but I got that. But I've certainly had that thing under wraps for many years.
Keep it there.
yeah, definitely.
We'll end there. The links are in the description for the show. You can connect with Wayne on his Facebook page. And the book is on Amazon, one-stop shopping. Thanks for listening.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Lowe's knows how to get you ready for holiday hosting with up to 35% off select home decor. And get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, members get free delivery, haul away, basic installation, parts, and a 2-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances.
Valid through 10-1. Member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Installed by independent contractors. Exclusions apply. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's,